Welcome to Semiobites, bite-sized podblog episodes related to theological semiotics.
Hi there, you're listening to a multi-part episode, so be sure to tune in and subscribe to catch all of this series of episodes to fully experience this topic.
And going back to our cohort work together, my dissertation in mine, that part of it that dealt with semiotic engineering, I make the point that there's the famous left brain, right brain, you know, which is a metaphor. It's not really left and right. It's really sentient and sapient mentality. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah. Your senses as the sentient, creative, intuitive, artistic side, and your sapient, which is the logic, language, analytic side. The scientist lives in the sapient world, the artist lives in the sentient world, that kind of distinction. I made the case, or tried to make the case, and I think I succeeded, in the dissertation that we're overlooking the control mechanism that has that resonant harmony between those two modes of mentality, right? Mm-hmm. That sits in the corpus callosum, which connects the senses that come in through your central nervous system to the thoughts that occur in those two modes of your mind. That's the corpus callosum. We're not aware of what goes on in the corpus callosum, but it is the conductor, the composer of the symphony of our sentient and sapient consciousness and awareness. And that this is a premise, a hypothesis, if you will, that I explain and defend in the dissertation. The point being, if you can control what the corpus callosum is doing semiotically, then your perception and intellectual understanding of truth and reality are shaped for you before you experience them. Mm-hmm. Now that's propaganda on steroids. That's far-fetched, I know, but I'm finding, as I study more and more of this biosemiotics, I'm finding that that's got a lot more depth and truth to it than even I thought it did. Now, but anyway, back to your point, if we're living in a world where that kind of propaganda, public relations, behavioral and mind control engineering, the MK Ultra psyops kind of spooky stuff, if we're living in a world where that is, let's say, anywhere from 10 to 20 years ahead of what we know publicly, which I don't think is a stretch, then there's no way to know what truth and reality are. It's the Matrix. I mean, the simplest metaphor is the Matrix.
And it's a great metaphor to describe that. So one thing, I trying to wrap it back here, an example to me about the toxicity of American patriotism as a fascist system, the tribalism is so overwhelming, I think, is what happened? the KKK procession and everything that occurred in Charlottesville, that.
Yeah.
I was recently at an anti-Semitism conference regarding the mainstream of anti-Semitism, and one of the conversation pieces was how the rioters did not dress like rioters, and they didn't dress like businessmen. They dressed like the average person in average clothing to send an image, to send a message that we are normal, we are mainstream.
Yeah.
And it's scary, but I think that's the future if we continue to go down this dangerous path of tribalism. Tribalism in a very small setting can help create unity and support for one another. But when taken and turned into a national system, or when taken and abused and misused, it creates a damaging environment. And the only other thing I can think of to explain that is nationalist socialism, the Nazi Party in Germany. There was such a semblance of German unity and German pride that the Jews at the time, before the Holocaust began, the Jews at the time, that they didn't count themselves, that lived in Germany, they weren't, oh, we're Jews that are German. They went, oh, we're German. We happen to be Jewish, but we're German first. They had that national pride. And well, it made it very hard for them when they found out that that didn't matter because they became the target. And it was over 12 years of semiotic engineering to take your neighbor that was human and turn them into a dog that you kick.
Yeah.
And they did it in the name of national pride.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, here we are.
That's what scares me about our current society. And that's what my concern is with the election. That's why I don't, there's a lot of reasons I don't want Trump in office. That's one of them. I do care about the environment. That's another one. So, that's just tying it back in with the conversation about the election. I think that's part of it too.
Yeah.
So one of the things, it's very brief because there's not much to discuss, not too much to discuss, I think, on it, is coronavirus.
Yeah.
You and I are both dealing with it, being border states in a way. I live in Portland, Oregon, and we're dealing with the schools panicking and freaking out and talking about how to quarantine and getting training. Oh, and there's this amazing video that I saw today of a politician at a press conference reading the recent CDC guidelines. And she's standing there. She says, and the number one way to try to keep yourself from getting the coronavirus is to make sure that you don't touch your face. And then she licks her finger to turn the page.
I know. Yeah, there you go.
So is coronavirus, it's a legitimate issue now because people are legitimately sick. Was it fabricated? I'm asking the conspiracy theorist in you, was this an experiment that got out of control?
Well, it's not a stretch. And I've got a little bit of backstory on it to explain why. The ground zero was Wuhan, China, right?
Yeah.
All right. In Wuhan, China, the laboratory, the main laboratory that is the biggest employer in town, I think, is a biological weapons laboratory. Go figure.
Huh.
And guess what? They use lots of laboratory animals, but bats is one of the main animals they use.
Which was a theory that maybe it came from bats.
You got it. Now, think about how scientific laboratories work. The myth that we are told to believe is that the laboratory technicians are PhD graduate students working for a noted scientist, Nobel laureate kind of person, right? And the
regardless of what may be an image, I'm not necessarily going to portray that with China, given that I know a 10-year-old built my iPhone.
Well, but building an iPhone is one thing. That's factory work. Laboratory work, supposedly, the myth that we buy, although we suspect that in China and outside the U.S., it's not that tight, it's not that loose. But here's the reality, or at least what I think could well be the reality. The laboratory workers, the ones who clean up the mess in the laboratory, are janitors. They're not graduate students, especially in a place like China. They're liable to be somewhere in elementary to high school range of literacy. And they are manual labor. And they are working for pittance income. Okay? And even the graduate students who are, say, lab technicians who do procedures on the animals, they're like a teaching assistant. And I will tell you, having been one, that a teaching assistant makes a little more than a pittance. But if I hadn't also been working as a waiter during Kentucky Derby week in Lexington while I was a graduate student, TA, I wouldn't have been able to pay my rent. Now, here's the real interesting factor. Guess which flying mammal is a delicacy in the Chinese diet?
Ugh. I'm glad I'm kosher.
Now it gets worse. If you take a bat onto the black market, you can make 2 to 3 times of a monthly wage for a janitor or a lab technician in Wuhan, China, for one bat. Wow. Now, with that information in your mind, what do you think the odds are?
Jenner says, oh, here's an extra payday. Oh, we have
I'll take
sickness.
A bag full of these bat carcasses to the black market where I go to buy my duck. Right?
Okay, yeah. There I can see go. How that's a...
That's a very plausible scenario. And this isn't my own take on it. I had this came out of a conversation with, I won't identify him by name, but a world-renowned climatologist.
It's very fascinating to see. I had somebody ask me if a government did this. And so I've been pondering it for the past few days. Now, granted, we are recording at the beginning of March, just as a reminder for our listeners. Today, I came across the revelation that there's two strains of the coronavirus out there, which is why they've been having issues developing treatment and vaccine, is that there is a more aggressive version and a less aggressive version, and the people with the mild symptoms are probably the ones getting the less aggressive version, but that the more aggressive one mutated from the less aggressive one.
That's the first I've heard of that. It's the first I've heard of it. I'm in Florida, by the way. You're in Portland. I'm in Orlando, the Orlando, greater Orlando area in St. Cloud, southeast by the airport. The reason that's a matter of concern, the only cases we've had so far, and this is about a day and a half old information for me, is around Tampa, which is over on the Gulf Coast, right? It's maybe two and a half hours from here. Lakeland is about halfway in between. That's where our daughter and son-in-law and three grandkids live. So I found it interesting that it showed up in Tampa first, because I actually expected it to show up in Orlando or Miami first, because Orlando and Miami are by far the leading two international tourist destinations in Florida. And Orlando's number one. Miami's a close second. Well, not even a very close second, but that I expected it to show up here first, but it's actually showed up in Miami first. I mean, Tampa. And it's not big numbers, at least it wasn't yesterday. I don't know, I haven't looked at it today, but they weren't big numbers. I think there were like six cases, no deaths yet. And I may be a little behind the curve on that, but I don't know how true that, I'm going to have to look into there being the two strains, but here's the scary part to me. And I wonder if this is true of both of those strains. This virus is contagious before the symptoms show up. In other words, as soon as that virus gets into your lungs, you're contagious. But you aren't suffering any symptoms. You don't have a flu. You don't have a temperature.
Which
is why it spreads so easily. Exactly. Now, is it an artifact? Two questions. One, is it an artifact or did it spring from nature? Is it an artifact and was its dispersion deliberate or accidental? To me, those are the key questions around it.
See, The person who watches too much sci-fi in me says that it's very much like a Resident Evil plot line. Oh, we're working on this virus. We're engineering it. And oh no, it got loose because of either they set it loose on purpose just to see what happened and then it mutated, or your scenario with the janitor happens and then maybe there's a mutation from there. I don't mean to be mean to China, but I wouldn't put it past experimenting on its own people.
What science fiction movie or book comes to mind right away?
Right. Well, there's a couple, but I'm mostly thinking of Resident Evil at the moment, which was a video game series that turned into a movie series, just because it just went sideways. There was experiments, and the experiment evolved, and they couldn't contain it.
Yeah.
And then they flew with it, and then experimented on the lack of containment.
Yeah. I go back a bit further to Michael Crichton's Andromeda Strain.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the other movie, and this one has really been weighing heavily on my mind lately, is Charlton Heston and Edward G. Robinson in Soylent Green.
Yes.
And you know what made me what made me think of that was Germany, I believe, and this was, I just kind of caught the headline and scanned the first couple of paragraphs of this article. But I ran across something about Germany, I believe it was Germany, is either considering or has already passed physician-assisted suicide legislation. Now, there are lots of countries in Scandinavia and Europe that have already done this. But the German block of legislation is one of the larger ones in the whole European group. Can't really say European Union anymore because of Brexit, but you see my point. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but think back to the movie Soylent Green while I was reading that article, especially that, you know the scene in there, do you know the movie?
I'm familiar with the concept of Soylent Green. I have not watched the film. I unfortunately watched Cloud Atlas, which I felt they tried to re-implement some of that film in it.
Really? Well, now, wait a minute. Cloud Atlas is not as old as the original Soylent Green.
No, Cloud Atlas is a recent film.
Right. Oh, so they tried to redo Soylent Green in Cloud Atlas, you're saying?
Yeah, in Cloud Atlas, the Wachowski, I think they're sisters now instead of brothers, but the Wachowskis, they came up with a storyline called Cloud Atlas. But there's a scene in there that was totally Soylent Green. So, and there's actually a scene where somebody's yelling out, "It's Soylent Green!" And then 20 minutes later, you find out it is.
Soylent Green is people. That's the line. Yeah. That's the closing line from the movie, the old movie. That's a great movie. And one of my favorite scenes in that movie is Charlton Heston, who's playing the cop. And this is a dystopian future movie where people are processed to become food. Spoiler alert. And Edward G. Robinson is his book. Now, what that means is detectives and cops didn't have the wherewithal to get educated enough to be very sophisticated in doing research. But getting good research was essential to them doing good investigation and crime solving. So instead of having a partner, like we normally think of two cops, two detectives working as a partner team, the cop had a book, which was usually an older person who was their research resource. Edward G. Robinson plays that part. And I don't want to do too much of a spoiler, but for those of you that are familiar, those of our listeners who are familiar with Plato's Apology of Socrates, there's a scene in this movie that is frame by frame a Socratic apology. I mean, frame by frame. If you know Plato's Apology, the instant they start that scene, you know that's what you're watching. It's beautiful. It's one of the best things in film, just as a particular scene. And I only bring that up because it was on my mind. But yeah, circling back on the coronavirus thing, you've piqued my interest. I need to look more into the two strains. I didn't know there were two strains of it.
Yeah, I just came across that today. And I guess it was a Chinese researcher announced it. So.
Interesting.
It's interesting. Today we talked a lot about politics and conspiracy theories. And unfortunately, I feel like they're too closely tied together.
They are. What's the Teotwaki acronym, right? Teotwaki, the end of the world as we know it.
Yeah.
When I was 20 years ago, that was a tinfoil hat, red flag conspiracy theory that was roundly rejected and laughed at and scoffed at by the entire scientific community. Here we are, quarter century later, and now, I don't know if you know this or not, there's a 100% consensus, 99.999%... consensus that the climate crisis is real and it's anthropogenic. We're the cause. The latest research is that high, 99.999% and dotting on out. So the end of the world as we know it is now prevailing scientific paradigm. So, I've been a conspiracy theorist for a long time. I don't think of it as a conspiracy theory. I think of it as conspiracy science.
Well, most science fiction, and in my opinion, having grown up with AOL not having existed at first. Most science fiction is just science that we haven't made happen yet.
Well, that we know of, we haven't made happen yet.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not that it can't happen. It's not that it's complete fiction. It's us acknowledging this is the future in some way or shape.
Yeah, yeah. Well, go back to Lynn's conception of grain out of his new book, Rings of Fire. Have you read that yet?
I have not.
I've read part of it. I went straight to the chapter on grain, genetics, robotics, artificial intelligence, and nanotech.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't let go of the idea that I'm the one who gave him that, but I don't care. It just kind of, you know, sits back there and nags at me from time to time. But anyway, genetics, robotics, artificial intelligence, and nanotech. What we know the state of the shelf to be, see, we only know the state of the shelf, what we can go to a company and buy. That's all we know about that technology. But how large, at first, if there is a gap between what we know at the state of the shelf and what's really state of the art in, let's say, oh, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the think tanks, the leading academic research universities that are on government contract, how big is the gap in grain between what we know that we can go buy from a company if we've just got, you know, $5 or $5 billion, and what's going on at that cutting edge of research and development? How big is that gap? 6 months? 2 years? 10 years? Because that's the gap that science fiction lives in. It's also the gap that conspiracy theory lives in to a large extent. Don't you think?
Yeah. It's, in my own way, it's Plum Island. That, I don't know. Are you familiar with Plum Island?
I am, but you should probably explain it for listeners.
So, East Coast, just off the coast, far enough away that it can do its own thing. This is Plum Island, a CDC-based research facility. And the reason it draws a lot of popularity is because of the Montauk Monster. And all you have to do is Google it, M-O-N-T-A-U-K. Please be aware, this is not suitable for children or work environments. It's creepy as hell, and you see it and you're like, you might need to go change your underwear after. But that's, it, to me, it's the most solid evidence there is of actual experimentation. And so when you say these things, it's like, well, there's evidence, there's proof. That's how I connect the dot.
Right.
Plum Island. That's what it is to me.
Well, MK Ultra. I mean, that stuff was done 50, 60 years ago. And it didn't surface until 10, 15 years ago, maybe 20. It was undercover. So that gap, that suggests to me that it depends on the weapons potential, for lack of a better phrase. It depends on how much profitability and weaponization potential there is in a technology as to how much effort goes into keeping it secret. The more potential there is to make profits from it and to weaponize it, the longer that period is.
Unless a janitor accidentally sells a virus.
And then until, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Well, and so, the first genetically modified human embryos came from where? China.
Yeah, CRISPR.
Right, right.
Yeah, that didn't go over well.
And the fascinating thing was, what I found fascinating was, the scientist who did that, CRISPR'd the embryo himself, was on the ethics committee on drafting rules and principles and guidelines for not doing it. Yeah. So talk about a Jekyll and Hyde.
You know, anyway. It's for me, it's a sad night when I come to realize that what I've always considered to be nuts and conspiracy theories may have an air of truth to it.
I've increasingly, Yoni, I've come to the position that if it comes into my attention, that's not an accident. Now, the reason that it may, the purpose it may serve in coming into my perceptual, conceptual realm can vary. It can be there as a cautionary red flag, you know, to teach me how not to think and feel, or it can come there to scare me into thinking and feeling in ways that I would rather avoid, or it can come there as confirmation bias, or it can come there as genuine corroboration of my beliefs. See, so I don't think things happen by accident. Now, that's not to say I'm deterministic, but I don't think that things happen by accident. It's a probabilistic universe in my mind. And I do think that there is divine design in what we experience as cognitive beings in that universe. Now, I assume you think so too.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Though we may think about it differently. We both think about it semiotically, right?
Yes. And I'm confident we both think about it monotheistically. We just have different paths in which we get there.
Right.
So that's a great tie-in to bring it back down to our conversation. Are you familiar with the concept of Dafyomi?
Say again?
It's called Dafyomi. It's Yomi is a day, right? And Daf is a page. And it's the Talmud. If one were to read one page of the Talmud every day, it would take them 7.5 years to finish it.
Okay.
And it takes about an hour to read that page. And so there's a morning class that people go to, and they go to this class every single morning to get through that page. And then every 7.5 years, we have a huge party. We call it a Siyam that just recently did one in New York. Anyway, so the cycle just restarted. And so currently we're... My group that I'm with for Daf Yomi, because I want to party in 7.5 years, we're a couple days behind. But in the Talmud sections on blessings and the types of blessings and prayers we're supposed to say, and today what we read was, it was interesting. It says, "Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Let your words therefore be few." So this was written down in a written form around 300 Common Era. The commentary, to try to explain it into more layman terms or today and how we think about things, is a lot easier. And it's more or less is this: let a person be sparing of complaints before God, since whatever he does is for the best. So I don't want to trivialize the issues going on. I think we have to take action, and we need to be aware, and we need to connect. And that's what we do with this podcast, is we start the dialogue. I think people need to take that to the next step and act on it and do something. But in the end, I have to understand that God's still in charge. So whatever I do or don't do, I got to do it. But in the end, he's still in charge.
I like that very much. Dafyomi, right?
Yeah, Dafyomi.
I like that very much. But I have a minor technical question. Do all Orthodox Jews do this in the same 7.5 year cycle, start to finish, or do different groups do it on different calendars?
So the Dafyomi cycle, it's literally everybody's reading the same page on the same day.
All Orthodox Jews?
Anybody who does it. You don't have to be Orthodox Jew. There's plenty. I know people who aren't Jewish that do it. And there's Orthodox Jews who don't do it. It's breakneck speed, learning things that you really don't get to fully comprehend and not getting a chance to dwell on it. And so it's not for everybody, but it's a great introduction to the basic bare bones of the Talmud. But the thing that really caught me was, we have our lives to live, but in the end, don't complain to God about it, because he chose for that for you, and he thought that's what was best for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I have no qualms or complaint or criticism against that.
I'm just trying to understand the world we live in.
Well, you know the Christian concept that what we go through in this life is exactly what God intends for us to go through. And I'll come back to the question of free will. But it is a dress rehearsal for what's coming under most Christian doctrine. We're being trained, if you will, in this life for what we do in the next life, the life after this one.
Yes, we have the same concept, right? This life is just a staging ground, just a training for the eternal life.
I thought they were similar, if not the same, in both Christian and Jewish dogma or creed, whatever, teaching. But this kind of discussion always raises the question of free will.
Yeah.
And I years ago, when I was first becoming a Christian, I was struggling with the dilemma of being a scientist trained in semiotic philosophy of science and an analytic philosopher, so that the only rational position was agnosticism. And then shortly after becoming a Christian, now I've got a cognitive dissonance, right? I've got all the scientific truth and analytic philosophy truth, and all of a sudden I've got to deal with, you know, the Christian image, the truth as a person, right?
Yeah.
So how do I put those two together? That's how I ended up in the same cohort with you at Portland Seminary. I was trying to put those two together. But very early, even before I even met Lynn Sweet, in trying to struggle through that dilemma or understand the dilemma itself, free will came up very early. Well, I had learned in logic all about possible world semantics. And I already accepted that my cognitive powers are finite. So the scope of all the possible worlds that I can conceive of is like, at best, a pail of sand on a beach, where the possible worlds in God's creation are all the grains of sand on all the beaches, on all the planets, everywhere in the universe, right? Mm-hmm. So I can make whatever free will decisions I like. And there's no way that I'm going to get beyond the scope of possibilities that God can already have worked out.
See, that's when I was a Christian, I had a very similar concept of God's got the main points figured out and everything else is up to interpretation.
Yep.
So, but I guess where I'm at now in my concept of free will and predestination is that we do have free will, but the reason people struggle with this concept of it is because God already knows what we decided, because he's outside of time. Time is a man-made construct.
Yeah.
And if God already knows what we decided, because everything's all the same for God, then we feel like it's destiny, but it's not. We're still going through our deciding process. He's just being a gentleman by not ruining and spoiling it for us.
Right. Let us feel like it's a free choice. Yeah.
Well, it is a free choice. He just happens to know what we chose, because he knows us then too.
Yeah, I was being glib.
No, I get what you mean. But this is a very, very basic argument that's very difficult. And in about 1 month, when Passover comes up, is how did Pharaoh, how did he have a choice? How did he have free will if God says he hardened his heart? And so the Jewish understanding, when we read the commentators, is that Haro was given the option three times. And then after that, God took away the choice. So that way, he used up his opportunities, because God knew what he was going to do, but he didn't want him to have any reward in the next world. So he gave him as many choices and pleasures as possible so that he didn't get rewarded for the good he did do.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's a good explanation.
That's how we understand the problem of suffering. Like, why do evil men succeed in this world? And we believe that every good thing we do does result in a reward. It's either here or it's in the world to come. Right. So God gives them all the rewards now so that they don't get it later.
Yeah.
And then
there's a certain justice to that. There's a certain justice to that. And that's the same in the Christian, as you know.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I don't know if we went a little sideways with that, but I think looking at it all is, despite the chaos with the election, and for me, what's going on with anti-Semitism, what's going on with the coronavirus and everything else, I know it'll be okay, even if it's not okay.
Well,
it may not be okay, but if it's what God intended, there's a reason.
People, you know the title of my dissertation, The End Signs, yes. Exclamation mark. Are we getting the message? Question mark. And it's astonishing how many, I'm not surprised, I anticipated how many people would immediately read that as an eschatological claim. End
times. That's a very Christian thing to do.
Exactly. And I kind of, you know, I almost didn't give it that title because it was such a slippery slope for a Christian reader. But then I had a second thought that said, let them go down that slope and see if they can find their way back. Because the whole point was to slide them into a world that was unfamiliar, but began with such a familiar concept that they had to work their way out of that perspective semiotically. And so I stuck with it for that. And I'm actually the title of the rewrite for the wider audience is The End Signs, exclamation point. Are we getting the message yet? Question mark. So I'm not really changing that strategy in doing the rewrite. But that's most people who read that title, I'm sure, start with the presumption of eschatology. You know, this is the end signs, it's the end times, it's the tribulation. And I'm going, I make no such claim, you know. I'm not, it's forbidden for me to know. So I'm not making any prediction or prognostication or prophecy that we are in the end times. No way. But I do know that there are signs of the end always with us. They just don't give us timing.
See, there's not the Jewish perspective, but one Jewish perspective that I've heard where there's, and this tied into some things I believed when I was a Christian too, where there's 6,000 years of man, and then there's the millennial reign, right? So there's a rabbi that made a comment, said, why is it that we've had so many progressive leaps in technology and population and how society grows within the past several generations compared to the rest of time? And the answer is because in the Jewish year, this year is year 5,780. We've got 220 years to go. And if we're supposed to bring about some sort of Messiah to fix the world, we have not done a good job of it.
We're running out of time. Yeah.
So because we're running out of time, God's speeding up our own growth system and our own expansion to try to bring it about a Messiah in time because we have failed.
I like that. I like that very much because as everything I learned about the climate crisis or what I call Melee R6, mass extinction level events on Earth, round six, that's what we're in. Everything I've learned about that, both in our cohort and in my dissertation work and since working with Extinction Rebellion and now Deep Adaptation and getting to know Guy McPherson up close and personal. He's here in Orlando. So I've had lunch with him, spent like 5 or 6 hours with him and his partner, and it was eye-opening. Now he's a persona non grata in the climate science community, because what he's been saying for the last decade is what's happening, and they started out by saying, "Oh, you're just so wrong, guy. It's nowhere near as drastic and severe as you think it is." Well, every day that goes by, the closer his predictions are coming out to be. He coined the phrase near-term human extinction, and he predicted it by 2030. And
almost there.
I know. And every IPCC report that comes out, those numbers are backing down from 2100 to 2080 to 2060. And some of the most severe signs are supposed to show up, guess when, even according to the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for the United Nations. They're the paradigm scientific community on climate change, climate crisis. The really tipping point signs are supposed to have already happened by 2030 on the latest IPCC reports, which says McPherson was onto something. He's the one, I don't know if you'd be interested or not. He's an atheist.
So?
I don't know if he'd be interested or not, Because for me, a Christian, and you, an Orthodox Jew, to come to him and say, would you do an interview with us about climate change in our podcast?
It's a comedy skit.
Well, for us, it's not a problem that he would be an atheist. I just don't know if it'd be a problem for him to do this for, you know, a Jew and a Christian. But I'm pretty sure I could get him to come on and do a session like this with us for an hour or so. So just it'd park that on the list.
Conversation. Yeah.
It'd be fascinating. You got to check him out.
You've sent me some links and everything.
Yeah. Go to his blog, GuyMcPherson.org. Might be com. But anyways, GuyMcPherson.something. And go to his blog. It's the title of his blog is Nature Bats Last.
Nice.
Yep.
There's some puns there. So on the slight topic of the environment, not delving into this as a big thing, right, but one of our conversations we had in the fall was there's an event coming up in the Jewish community here about climate change and what does it have to do with Jews, like, and that type of thing. And your comment was, well, you better be going to that. And I said, yeah, I know, I'm going to it. But my Rav is one speaking at it. I have since then become involved with the Climate Change Committee with the local Jewish Federation. And there's a larger movement within the federations and worldwide to have a Jewish climate change dialogue and start the ball rolling on that.
I couldn't have had better news from you.
So I've always been concerned about sustainability and everything, and now I have an outlet to express it when people don't think I'm as much of a hippie anymore.
So, well,
you don't use dryer sheets? No, why would I? They destroy the environment.
No, I've seen in your posts on social media and in some of your Yidbrick posts, I've seen the shift in your perspective on that. And it's delightful from where I sit.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to come to terms with. And I think that's the struggle at first for people is coming to terms with the fact that the world's falling apart and we got to do something about it, even if we fail.
Yeah, that's square one. One of the reasons I backed off in my, well, I had personal reasons first and foremost, but I would have taken the step away from Extinction Rebellion and only being kind of peripherally involved as the local coordinator anyway. But one of the reasons for doing it was Extinction Rebellion has one huge story to tell, which is the science.
Yeah.
If you want to understand the science around the climate crisis, Extinction Rebellion talks are a great place to go and do that. And from there, you can go into all kinds of other venues and groups and things. But when it comes to what to do about it, they really only, and they're almost hypocritical here, because they have one of the three demands says they don't trust the government. But what do? The one thing they tell you, the one action they tell you to take is to get in the streets, nonviolent direct action, civil disobedience, in the face of the government, you know, to have them do citizens' assemblies and let those citizens' assemblies lead the government in dealing with this crisis. Well, how do you reconcile that with the demand that says we don't trust the government? You know, so, but that's the only real action that Extinction Rebellion throws itself into. Now, they have kind of peripheral things around that are regeneration culture to help you regenerate your worldview around this new knowledge, you know, but it's kind of incidental to the main thrust. The other group that I'm involved in, Deep Adaptation, it's less than a year old, or maybe just at a year. It does the opposite. It's much less concerned about nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience and all that. And it's not really all that concerned about teaching you the science, although it does do that. There's an abundance of it. What it's really focused on is, at an individual and group community level, how do you help people wrap their heart, soul, and mind and body around this truth and reality of climate crisis. It's coming, it's ministry. In religious terms, for both you as a Jew and me as a Christian, it would be the ministry to people who are just beginning to come out, to wake up to the truth and reality of the mass extinction that we're in. And they call it deep adaptation. And I'm ashamed to say it's based on four principles that I cannot remember at the moment. They all start with an R. Resilience, relinquishment. Can't remember the third one. The last one is reconciliation. But it has to do with figuring out what you need to give up, figuring out what you need to keep, and figuring out how to reconcile with the people, for instance, who aren't awake yet or actually caused the problem, like fascist capitalists. So that's why I got involved with deep adaptation, because Extinction Rebellion wasn't addressing any of that. Yeah. And you might want to, in your role, with the groups you're working in your community, in your Jewish larger world, you might want to look at deep adaptation. It's also based in the UK by UK, it's not Oxford, he's in Cumbria, University of Cumbria. It's in the university system of England. And his name is Jim, J-E-M, Bendell, B-E-N-D-E-L-L. But if you look at deep adaptation, just search it, you'll find the key websites.
But yeah, we talked about Extinction Rebellion, and one of the leaders in Extinction Rebellion made some comments that caused a lot of ruckus.
Yeah.
It wasn't Jim Bendell, but we have talked about Jim Bendell before.
Well, Jim was with Extinction Rebellion until he wrote this paper called Deep Adaptation, A Map for Navigating Climate Crisis, Climate Emergency, something like that. And he wrote this paper, I want to say, in middle of 2018. Later. I think it was middle of 2018, August, July 2018. And it was roundly rejected by the academic community. It's never been peer-reviewed and accepted for publication. But it's in the archives of the university where he teaches. He's a philosophy professor. No, he's a social science professor. And it's in the archives there. And it went viral from there, just as a working paper. But the scholarly, academic, conservative community circled their wagons against it. But he didn't back down. He's kept going. He's built this whole deep adaptation movement around it, and it's quite promising. Like I say, it fills in. XR and deep adaptation are like two sides of the same coin. They're made of the same stuff, all around the Melee R6 mass extinction level events. But there are two different ways of facing it. One is nonviolent direct action around the three demands of Extinction Rebellion. And the other is, how do we adapt cognitively to the truth and reality of what's happening? Individually, how do we do that? And then immediate, most beloved and cherished ones, your family, and then local community, and then out from there. And there's a lot around sustainability, resilience, permaculture. A lot of that is very active within the deep adaptation community, much less so in XR. And there's not nearly as much nonviolent direct action in deep adptation as there is in Extinction Rebellion. So they're like two sides of the same coin for me. And I'm, of course, troublemaking, irascible, old fart in both groups. We've been on this a long time. Can you make this two or three episodes?
You know, I thought about it. And I was like, we'll give our listeners an afternoon worth of listening.
So, you might just insert a break point here and there and say, this would be a good place to stop and come back, because there's 2.5 hours left or whatever, you know.
Well, see, that's the beauty, though, of podcast players these days, is someone can download, they can see the length, and they can hit pause when they need to. I definitely do it. There's this one podcast I listen to. It's regularly 2 hours long each episode, and I hit pause, and I come back later. And it's great and it's fun. It's a debate. It's kind of like similar to what we do, only it's all about Jewish law and what's going on in the headlines with that. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think we've done enough content for our listeners today. We've really addressed not just the state of the union, but the state of the world. We're dealing with a lot of things going on right now. And semiotically and religiously, it can be a lot to handle. And I think that's why we're seeing people respond the way that they do, where they try to find what's safe and familiar and just hold on to their binky.
Yeah.
So
I agree. You're right. It's been a pleasure. It's been a delight. Look forward to more. Let's not wait so long this time.
True. It's not as long for the listener, but it is longer for us. This has been a long time to record season two. So,
yeah. All right. Then. All right.
Talk to you later.
Same here.
Send questions, comments, and suggestions to semiobites@gmail.com. Semiobites is a podcast co-hosted by Yidbrick and Semio City that answers Semitic questions via Semiyak analysis by addressing misunderstandings to build a bridge of shalom between Judaism and Christianity. Semiobites is a component of the Track 2 dissertation process at Portland Seminary for Jonathan Esterman and Terry Rankin.